injurious effects. In fact, the bibliography contained articles as far back as 1906 on the damage radium could cause. The company later conceded in an internal memo that there were a considerable number of articles dealing with the hazards from the early 20th century. A woman had even died in Germany in 1912 after being treated with radium. Her doctor had said, "One cannot doubt for a moment that radium poisoning was the cause." Yet the flip side of the coin was all the positive literature about radium. As early as 1914, specialists knew that radium could deposit in the bones of radium users and that it caused changes in their blood. These blood changes, however, were interpreted as a good thing. The radium appeared to stimulate the bone marrow to produce extra red blood cells. Deposited inside the body, radium was the gift that kept on giving. But if you looked a little closer at all those positive publications, there was a common denominator. The researchers, on the whole, worked for radium firms. As radium was such a rare and mysterious element, its commercial exploiters, in fact, controlled, to an almost monopolizing extent, its image and most of the knowledge about it. Many firms had their own radium-themed journals, which were distributed free to doctors, all full of optimistic research. The firms that profited from radium medicine were the primary producers and publishers of the positive literature. Zamatolsky's opinion, therefore, was a lone, unheard, and hypothetical voice set against the flamboyant roar of a well-funded campaign of pro-radium literature. Zamatolsky himself, however, was a conscientious as well as smart man. Given his tests would take a few months, and mindful of the fact that work was continuing in the dial painting studio, he took care to add a special note to his letter of January 30th. Though his radical theory had not yet been proven, he wrote plainly, "I would suggest that every operator be warned through a printed leaflet of the dangers of getting this material on the skin or into the system, especially the mouth, and that they be forced to use the utmost cleanliness." Yet for some reason, this did not happen. Perhaps the message was never passed on. Perhaps the company chose to ignore it. As 1923 drew on, and Zamatolsky ran his tests, Irene Rudolph, who had been sent home from the hospital, continued to endure the horrific ulcers and sores that had tortured Molly Maggia. Irene's anemia grew more serious, as did Helen Quinlan's. They were pale, weak creatures with no energy to them, no life. Doctors treated them first for one thing and then another, but not a single treatment helped. And they weren't the only ones who were sick. Since George Willis, the co-founder of the Orange Radium firm, had been ousted from his company, things had deteriorated for him. It seemed a long time ago that he had thoughtlessly carried tubes of radium with his bare hands every day at work. But all time is relative. With a half-life of 1,600 years, radium could take its time to make itself known. As the months had passed since his departure from the company, Willis had sickened, and in September 1922, the same month Molly Maggia died, he'd had his right thumb amputated. Tests revealed it was riddled with cancer. Willis didn't keep his sickness to himself. Instead, he published his findings. In February 1923, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, he wrote, "The reputation for harmlessness enjoyed by radium may, after all, depend on the fact that, so far, not very many persons have been exposed to large amounts of radium by daily handling over long periods. There is good reason to fear that neglect of precautions may result in serious injury to the radium workers themselves. What his former company thought of his article is not recorded. They probably dismissed it. He didn't work for them anymore, thus he did not matter. And they weren't the only ones to ignore it. No one, it seemed, took much notice of the small article in the specialist publication. By the April of 1923, Zamatolsky had completed his tests. As he had suspected, there was not a single trace of phosphorus in the luminous paint. "I feel quite sure," he therefore wrote on April 6th, 1923, "that the opinion expressed in my former letter is correct. Such trouble as may have been caused is due to the radium." 8. Ottawa, Illinois, 1923. The radium, the girls in Ottawa thought, was one of the best things about their new job. Most women who worked in the town at that time were shop girls, secretaries, or factory workers. This was something a little different. No wonder it was the most popular gig in town. Girls from all walks of life tried their hand at it, drawn by radium's allure. "Some dial painters were what I call slumming," said one of their colleagues with more than a hint of disapproval. One worker was the darling daughter of a prominent physician, one of the better people. She and her friend were just there for a few days. The well-off women simply wanted to see what it was like to be one of the ghost girls, a kind of voyeuristic life tourism. Perhaps as a result of their interest, Mrs. Reed had her training room all dolled up like a kindergarten. It boasted curtains at the windows and flowers in a porcelain vase. Radium Dial had initially advertised for 50 girls, but would eventually employ as many as 200. More workers were needed to keep up with demand. In 1923, Westclox, Radium Dial's main client, had a 60% share of the U.S. alarm clock market, worth $5.97 million, $83 million. So many girls wanted to become dial painters that the company could afford to be choosy. The practice, a former employee recalled, was to hire about 10 girls at a time and try them out. Out of the 10, they would usually keep about 5. One who made the grade was Margaret Looney, whose family called her Peg. She was good friends with Catherine Wolfe. They had gone to the same parish school, and Peg also attended St. Columbia across the way, as did the vast majority of radium dial workers. Everyone knew the Looney family. At the time Peg started at Radium Dial in 1923, there were 8 kids in the clan. That number would eventually grow to 10. The whole family lived in a cramped house right on the railroad tracks, where the roar of the trains was so frequent that they didn't even think about it anymore. It was a very tiny house, 1 story, wood frame, and 4 rooms, basically, said Peg's niece, Darlene. It had 2 bedrooms, and the big bedroom, where the kids slept, had blankets hanging from the ceiling, separating the girls' side from the boys'. There'd be 3 to 4 kids in a bed. They were dirt poor, just as poor as you could be. But they were close-knit. You had to be, at such close quarters. And they had fun. Peg, a slender, freckled redhead who was tiny in stature, was known for her giggling fits. And as the eldest girl, she was 17, her siblings looked up to her and followed her lead. In the summer, the Looney children would run around barefoot because they couldn't afford shoes, but it didn't stop their games with their neighborhood friends. Given her family background, Peg was thrilled to land a job as a well-paid dial painter. She earned $17.50, $242, a week. Good money for a poor Irish girl from a large family, and gave her mom most of it. The job meant she had to park her ambition to become a school teacher, but she was still young. There was plenty of time to teach later on in life. She was a very intelligent girl, so scholarly that in high school, her favorite hobby had been trying to hide behind the dictionary, which she used to read in a delightful sunny nook. She had the smarts to make it as a school teacher, but she would dial paint for a time to help out at home. Anyway, she had a good time at work, painting with her friends. Peg started out, as did all the new girls, by painting the Big Ben alarm clocks that West Clocks produced. He was a rugged, handsome fellow of a clock, with a dial that measured about 10 centimeters across, giving him nice, big numbers for the less experienced girls to paint. As they gained in skill, they were moved on to the Baby Bens, smaller clocks about half the size, and eventually to the pocket watches, the Pocket Ben and the Scotty, which were just over 3 centimeters wide. Peg held the dials in her hand as she carefully traced the numbers with the greenish-white paint, lipping and dipping her camel hair brush as she had been taught. The paper dial was mounted on a slim metal disc, cool to the touch. It had little ridges on it at the back, by which it would later be attached to the rest of the clock. Sitting alongside Peg in the studio was another new joiner, Marie Becker. She'd been working for the bakery downtown, but as one of her relatives observed, Radium Dial was the place that paid more money than any place else. Marie's wages would double if she took up dial painting. Consequently, she was sold. Marie needed the income, her relative went on, so that's why she started to work there. Like Peg, Marie came from an underprivileged background. After her father had died of dropsy, her mother remarried, and when Marie was only 13, her stepfather set her to work. She'd done all sorts of jobs since then, the bakery, factory work, and being a salesgirl at the dime store. Her stepfather's instruction was something Marie had taken in her stride, as she did all things in life. Her attitude was wonderful, a close relative said. I don't ever remember her being in a bad mood. You know how other people get grudges, or they get a chip on their shoulder? Never. She was a ball of wax. She laughed a lot. She laughed loud. Her laugh would make you laugh. She was an instant hit in the dial painting studio. Marie was a real character, full of opinions and wisecracks. She was a skinny minnie with dimples who, despite her German heritage, had almost a Spanish look to her, with striking dark eyes and long brown hair, which she wore in a bun, sometimes with a spit curl on her forehead. She became good pals with Charlotte Nevins and declared Peg Looney to be her closest friend. At first, however, Marie wasn't sure about staying there. On her first day at work, she was taught to put the brush in her mouth, and she hated it. When she went home at lunchtime that day, she told her mother, bluntly, that she wouldn't return because she just didn't like that idea of putting the brush in her mouth. But it was a short-lived reluctance, for, despite her dislike of the work, she was drawn back to the studio the following day. She stayed because of the money, a relative remarked somberly. Those high wages were so hard to say no to. Not that Marie saw them. The money went to her stepfather, her relative continued. He was very strict, a very stern man. She had to give him the money. Marie hated it, and it was especially hard for her because most of the other girls at the studio could keep their money, and they spent it on the latest fashions at T. Lucy and Brothers, where girls could buy corsets, gloves, laces, ribbons, fancy goods, and notions. Marie dreamed of spending her wage on high heels, which she loved. One day, she'd had enough. She'd earned the money, not her stepfather, and she thought to herself that when she got paid that week, she would go straight to the shoe store and splurge her hard-earned cash on a pair of fabulous shoes, her very first pair of high heels. And she did just that. She even told the clerk not to bother wrapping them because she was going to walk right out of the shop with the heels on. "That was Marie," exclaimed a relative fondly. She knew if she wore those shoes home, there was nothing her stepfather could do. And there wasn't. Marie had an argument with him about not handing over her check, and then eventually moved out when she was 17. Thanks to her wages and her spirit, she was well able to. Marie's new feistiness was a sign of the times. It was the roaring 20s, after all, and even in a tiny town like Ottawa, the breeze of female independence and fun times was stirring the sidewalks, blowing the winds of change. The dial painters were full of youth and beauty, just itching to get out there and see the world. And what a time to be doing it! Prohibition was huge in Ottawa, remarked a resident. There was a lot of drinking and gambling joints. And not just that, big bands and good times. The dial painters were among those dancing to the 20th century jazz boys and, later, Benny Goodman. The year 1923 was when the Charleston dance craze took America by storm, and the radium dial girls swiveled their knees with the best of them. The luminous glow of the radium on their hair and undulating dresses made those parties even more special. Many of the girls, Catherine Wolfe recalled, used to wear their good dresses to the plant so that they would become luminous when they went out to parties later. It gave the girls even more reason to invest in high-end fashion. They bought the latest cloche hats, high heels with bows upon them, handbags, and strings of pearls. And it wasn't just after work that the good times roared, either. In work, too, the girls had a blast. As in Orange, the bosses, Mr. and Mrs. Reed and Miss Murray, worked downstairs, giving the girls on the second floor a free rein to have fun. In their lunch hour, the girls would go into the dark room with the leftover radium paint. They'd had a swell idea for a new game. We used to paint our eyebrows, our lips, and our eyelashes with the remaining radium paint, and then look at ourselves in the dark room, recalled Marie. The girls would always get fresh jars of material for the afternoon's work, so they had carte blanche to use up the surplus paint from the morning. Marie used to dab the glowing mixture freely around her nostrils and along her eyebrows, and then give herself an elaborate mustache and a comedy chin. The girls would all make faces at each other. They thought it was hilarious. Charlotte Nevins remembered that they would turn the lights off, and then we could look in the mirror and laugh a lot. We glowed in the dark. Yet for all the laughter, it was a strangely spooky vision. In the dark room, no daylight shone. There was no light at all, except for the glowing element the girls had painted on their bare skin. They themselves were completely invisible. All you could see was the radium. But, as Marie herself said, it was all just for fun. More and more girls joined them at Radium Dial. Frances Glachinsky, Ella Cruz, Mary Duffy, Ruth Thompson, Sadie Prey, Della Harveston, and Inez Corcoran were among them. Inez sat right next to Catherine Wolfe in the studio. "We were a bunch of happy, vivacious girls," remembered Charlotte Nevins fondly, "the brightest of the girlhood of Ottawa. We had our own little clique." That clique worked together, danced together, and had outings along the river and at Starved Rock, a local beauty spot. They were such good, good times. And, as Catherine's nephew later said of those halcyon days, they thought it was never going to end. 9. Orange, New Jersey, June 1923. It was the roaring 20s in Orange, too. But Grace Fryer wasn't in the mood for dancing. It was odd. She had this slight pain in her back and feet, nothing major, but enough to make it uncomfortable for her to walk. Dancing definitely wasn't on the agenda, even though the girls at the bank were still throwing their parties. She tried to put it to the back of her mind. She'd had a few aches and pains the year before, too, but they came and went. Hopefully, when these latest aches cleared up, they would simply go for good. She was just run down, she reasoned. I thought that this was merely a touch of rheumatism and did nothing about it. Grace had far more important things to think about than an achy foot. She'd been promoted at work and was now the head of her department. It wasn't just an achy foot troubling her, however. Back in January, Grace had gone to the dentist for a routine checkup. He'd removed 2 teeth, and, although an infection had lingered for 2 weeks, her trouble had then cleared up. But now, 6 months on, a hole had appeared at the side of the extraction and was leaking pus profusely. It was painful and smelly and tasted disgusting. Grace had health insurance and was prepared to pay to get it sorted out. The doctors, she was sure, would be able to fix her trouble. But had she known what was happening just a few miles away in Newark, she might have had reason to doubt her faith in physicians. Grace's former colleague, Irene Rudolph, was still paying doctor after doctor to treat her, but without relief. She had, by now, undergone both operations and blood transfusions, but to no avail. The decay in Irene's jaw was eating her alive bit by bit. She could feel herself weakening. Her pulse would pound in her ears as her heart beat faster to try to get more oxygen around her severely anemic body. But although her heart was drumming faster and faster, it felt to her like her life was inexorably slowing down. In Orange, for Helen Quinlan, the drumbeat suddenly stopped. She died on June 3, 1923, at her home on North Jefferson Street. Her mother, Nellie, was with her. Helen was 22 years old at the time of her death. The cause of it, according to her death certificate, was Vincent's angina. This is a bacterial disease, an agonizing and progressive infection that begins in the gums and steadily spreads until the tissue in the mouth and throat, swollen and ulcerated, finally sloughs off, dead. Her doctor later said he didn't know if the disease was confirmed by laboratory tests, but it was written on her death certificate nonetheless. The angina, in its name, is derived from the Latin angera, meaning to choke or throttle. That's what it felt like when the decay in her mouth finally reached her throat. That's how Helen died, this girl who had used to run with the wind in her skirts, making boyfriends gaze and marvel at her zest for life and her freedom. She had lived an impossibly short life, touching those who knew her. Now, Suddenly, she was gone. 6 weeks later, Irene Rudolph followed her to the grave. She died on July 15, 1923, at 12 noon in Newark General Hospital, where she'd been admitted the day before. She was 21. At the time of her death, the necrosis in her jaw was said to be complete. Her death was attributed to her work, but the cause was given as phosphorus poisoning, a diagnosis admitted by the attending physician to be not decisive. Catherine Sharp, who had watched her cousin suffer through every stage of what she called her terrible and mysterious illness, was angry and confused, as well as grief-stricken. She knew Irene had spoken to Dr. Allen about her fears that her sickness had been caused by her job, but since then, the family had heard nothing. They didn't know the names John Roach or Dr. Zamitolsky. They knew nothing of the doctor's verdict following his tests. In fact, after reviewing Zamitolsky's report and that of the two inspectors, the Department of Labor took no action. No action whatsoever. Catherine was an intelligent, determined young woman. If the authorities weren't going to do anything, well, then she would. On July 18th, the Sharbs buried Irene, who had lived such a short, sad life. And the next day, fueled by sorrow and the senseless waste, Catherine went to the Department of Health on Franklin Street. She had a report she wished to make, she told the official there. And she told him all about Irene and her tragic death, and how Molly Maggia had died of the same sort of poisoning a year ago. It was the United States Radium Corporation, she made sure to say, on Alden Street in Orange. Still another girl, she reported, is now complaining of trouble. And, she said clearly, they have to point the brushes with their lips. That was the cause of all this trouble, all this agony, all this death. Report filed, Catherine left, hoping and assuming that something now would be done. A memo was filed about her visit. At the end, it said, simply, a foreman at the plant, by the name of Veit, said her claims were not true. And that was that. Helen and Irene's deaths had not gone unnoticed by their former colleagues, at least. Many of the girls I knew and had worked with in the plant began to die off alarmingly fast, observed Quinta MacDonald. They were all young women, in good health. It seemed odd. That summer, however, Quinta was caught up in all things family, and had no time to give the situation much more thought than that. On July 25th, she gave birth to her second child, Robert. We were all so darn happy together, she remembered of that time. She and her husband, James, now had the perfect family, a little boy and a little girl. The kid's Aunt Albina, who was still waiting for the blessing of her first child, doted on them both. During her pregnancy, like many women, Quinta had suffered swollen ankles. Although Helen's birth had been relatively easy, she'd struggled with Robert. It was a difficult labor, and forceps had been used. After his birth, she'd assumed she'd get well, but instead developed a bad back, and her ankles still bothered her. I hobbled around, she later recalled. She treated the problem with household remedies. And then I went to bed one night, she remembered, and woke up in the morning with terrible pains in my bones. She called out a local doctor, and he began treating her for rheumatism. His call-out fee was $3, $40 a pop, and she and James could have done without the additional expense given the new baby, but she just couldn't seem to shake the pains. By the end of the year, she would have seen the doctor 82 times. As the summer of 1923 drew to a close, Catherine Sharb's complaint from the middle of July was finally investigated by Lenore Young, an Orange health officer. She looked up the dead girl's records and found that Molly Maggia had died of syphilis and Helen Quinlan of Vincent's angina. "I tried to get in touch with Veit," she added, "but he was out of town." And so she did nothing. "I let the matter drop. It has been neglected, but not out of my mind entirely." Had the dial painters been privy to her correspondence, those words would have been cold comfort indeed to those continuing to suffer, including Hazel Vincent. Hazel was still being treated for pyorrhea, and still having teeth extracted. They were like old friends dying off, one by one, until her own mouth felt like a stranger. By now she could no longer work, as the pain was unbearable. For her friends and family, it was intolerable to watch. For Theo in particular, who had loved her since they were teenagers, he felt like he was feeling his future disintegrate in his arms. He begged her to let him pay for the doctors and the dentists that she went to, but she was unwilling to accept money from him. He wasn't going to stand for that. This was the woman he loved. If she wouldn't accept help from him as her boyfriend, would she accept it if she was his wife? And so, even though Hazel was very ill, he married her, because he believed that if she was his wife, he would be more able to take care of her. They stood before the altar together, and he promised to love her in sickness and in health. The new bride wasn't the only radium girl suffering that fall. In October 1923, Marguerite Carlo, who was still working in the studio, developed a severe toothache that made her face swell up. And then, in November, another young woman fell ill. "I began to have trouble with my teeth," wrote Catherine Sharb. Catherine had seen firsthand what Irene went through. When her mouth started to ache, it must have shot a bolt of terror right through her. She was brave. She didn't ignore it. Instead, on November 17th, she went to the same dentist who had treated Irene to see if he could help her where all his efforts had failed for her cousin. Dr. Barry removed two of her teeth. He noticed, as he examined them, that they were flinty and broke easily. He added in her file, "Patient has been employed in radium works in Orange, same place as Miss Rudolph." Catherine was told to come back soon. And she did, again and again. Following the tooth extraction, her gum failed to heal, and she returned very frequently to Dr. Barry's office, 5 times within that same month, at a charge of $2, $27 each visit. The extraction had cost $8, $111. Catherine wasn't stupid. "I kept thinking about Irene," she said anxiously, "and about the trouble she had had with her jaw. There was some relationship between Irene's case and mine." She also realized Irene had necrosis. She died. Catherine's always vivid imagination, now fueled by the knowledge of what she had seen Irene suffer, soon became a constant, flickering cinereal, silently playing out what must lie before her over and over. She was seriously shocked, and a severe nervousness developed, which affected her mental health, a situation that did not improve when, on December 16, 1923, Catherine O'Donnell, another former co-worker, passed away. The doctors said she died of pneumonia and gangrene of lung, but Catherine didn't know for sure. And so, Catherine became another ghost girl to haunt her in her head. She was buried in the same cemetery where, 6 months earlier, Irene had been laid to rest. So many girls were ailing. As Christmas approached, Grace Fryer was conscious that although her jaw seemed to be getting better, the pain in her back and foot had become worse. "My foot was stiff. I couldn't bend it," she remembered. "When I walked, I had to walk with my foot real flat." Yet she'd soldiered on throughout the fall and didn't ask for help. "I said nothing about my condition to anyone." But she couldn't pull the wool over her parents' eyes. Daniel and Grace Fryer watched their eldest daughter as she went about her life, commuting to the bank, helping out at home, playing with her young nieces and nephews. And they saw that her gait, which had always been confident and unhindered, had changed. She was limping, despite herself. They couldn't let this go on. Toward the end of 1923, their daughter Grace conceded, "My condition became noticeable, and my parents insisted that I see a doctor." Dutifully, she made an appointment at the Orthopedic Hospital in Orange for January 5, 1924. Before that was Christmas. By Christmas Eve, 1923, Marguerite Carlo felt at her wit's end. All fall she'd struggled on, continuing her work at the studio in spite of increasing ill health. Lip pointing had been stopped in late 1923. Josephine Smith, the forelady, revealed, "When the company warning was given about pointing brushes in our mouths, it was explained to the girls that this was because the acid in the mouth spoiled the adhesive." Marguerite had followed the new orders. Her mind wasn't on the job, though. She couldn't concentrate as she'd used to. She had extreme fatigue, was pale and weak, and her toothache, which had started in October, was driving her insane. Unable to eat, the weight had dropped off her at an alarming rate. The smart, tailored clothes she favored were now hanging off her frame, no longer made to fit her newly scrawny figure. When she left for work that December 24th, she didn't know it, but it would be for the very last time, because that same evening she visited her dentist. There were two teeth that were especially hurting her, and her dentist advised that both should be removed that same day. Marguerite consented to the extraction. When her dentist pulled the teeth, a piece of decayed jawbone came out, too. She wasn't going back to the studio after that. She went home, instead, to her sister, Sarah, and her niece, Marguerite, to her mom and dad, and she tried to tell them what had happened. Christmas Day was a sober, solemn occasion after her gruesome experience, but at least they were all together. Given the absences in other New Jersey homes that winter, that was something to be grateful for. Unbeknownst to the Carlos, or to any of the dial painters, that same month, the U.S. Public Health Service issued an official report on radium workers. Though it noted that no serious defects had been found among the staff examined, it revealed that there had been two cases of skin erosion and one case of anemia among the nine technicians studied. As a result, it made a formal recommendation to the nation, to New Jersey, and to Illinois, to Connecticut, where the Waterbury Clock Company was painting its own dials, and to all the places where radium was used. Safety precautions, the report said, should most definitely be undertaken by those handling radium. 10. Ottawa, Illinois, 1923. The caretaker at Radium Dial wiped his bare hands down his work shirt. He was covered in luminous material, his clothing stiff with it. The only clear spots on his face were where two big drools of chewing tobacco ran down his chin. He liked to chew as he worked, and he wasn't the only one. The dial painters kept candy on their desks, snacking between dials without washing their hands, a habit that suited the many teenagers employed. As time went on, the current Ottawa high school students were among them. They would work one summer between high school years from a few to several weeks, just to earn a bit of pocket money. As in Orange, the girls encouraged friends and family to join them at the studio. The old high school was a lovely building to work in, a grand Victorian brick edifice with huge arched windows and high ceilings. Frances Glachinsky was thrilled when her little sister Marguerite, 2 years younger, came along to work on the second floor with Catherine, Charlotte, Marie, Peg, and all the rest. Marguerite was a pretty girl who was described as comely. She and her sister were of Polish heritage. The girls also welcomed 15-year-old Helen Munk, a thin, dark girl who wore scarlet lipstick and painted her nails to match. She was the kind of person who wanted to be going all the time. The exception to these teenagers was Pearl Payne, a married woman from nearby Utica. Pearl was 23 when she started at Radium Dial, a good 8 years older than some of her colleagues. She had married Hobart Payne, a tall, slender electrician who wore glasses, in 1922. She described him as a fine husband. He was a man who told jokes and loved children. Folks described him as a very knowledgeable guy. In fact, his wife was full of smarts, too. Pearl was the eldest girl of 13 children, and although she had to leave school at 13 to earn money for the family, she revealed, "During my employment, I attended night school and a private teacher, completing 7th and 8th grade and 1 year of high school." And her education didn't stop there. During the war, she'd gained a nursing diploma and was all set to start a career at a Chicago hospital. When her mother was taken ill, Pearl had quit to care for her. Now her mom had recovered, Pearl was returning to work, and dial painting, which was better paid than being a nurse, was what she ended up doing. Pearl and Catherine Wolfe got on especially well. Pearl was a gentle woman. "Never an unkind word from her mouth, ever," said her nephew Randy. The two women's personalities dovetailed neatly, and their shared experience of nursing relatives, for Catherine took responsibility for her elderly aunt and uncle, brought them closer. Catherine, 3 years younger than Pearl, described her as a "dearest friend." Funnily enough, the two women also looked alike. Pearl had thick, dark hair and pale skin, too, though she was rounder-faced and more full-figured than Catherine, and her hair was curly. Pearl overlapped with Charlotte Nevins by only a few months. In the fall of 1923, Charlotte quit her job at Radium Dial to become a seamstress. She had been a dial painter for only 13 months. As had been the case in Orange, however, any time a girl left, a dozen more arrived to take her place. Olive West now joined the studio, becoming close with Catherine and Pearl. All were overseen by Assistant Superintendent Mr. Reed, Miss Murray's deputy, with whom the girls often shared a joke. On his occasional forays into their studio, The dial painters would tease him, and it was an affectionate repartee that cut both ways. One young woman remembered, "I was to be married, and I remember going to work that morning in the dress and telling the supervisor, Reed, I was quitting and on my way to be married. He joked and said, 'Don't come back, you won't have a job.' But she concluded, 'I was back at work in a couple of weeks.'" As Mr. Reed was deaf, the girls would sometimes talk back to him as he couldn't hear them, but it was all good-natured, and they enjoyed working with him. "I never heard of any of them not getting along, never," said Peg's sister Jean. "Everybody was generous and good to one another." It was such a lovely atmosphere that Peg Looney found herself falling for the job and forgetting all about her ambition to become a school teacher. She was extremely conscientious and would even take dials home to paint, carefully tracing the numerals in that cramped house next to the railroad tracks that she shared with her large family. "She looked after us real good," remembered her sister Jean of Peg, sharing her good fortune with them. Another sister, Jane, recalled Peg buying her a gorgeous cobalt dress with decorative white trimmings, a typically generous gift on the occasion of Jane's eighth-grade graduation. The sisters all agreed she was everything you'd hope a big sister would be. Peg not only brought her wages and her work home, but also the games she learned at the studio. She entertained the younger siblings with "Let's Go in the Dark," revealed Peg's niece, Darlene. And there they would glow, a row of little loonies with radium mustaches, shining sprites behind the blankets they'd put up for modesty in the tiny bedroom. Peg's sister, Catherine, the nearest to her in age, was enamored of all she saw and longed to join Peg at the studio, though she never did. Everyone wanted to work there. That was why Pearl Payne was so disappointed when, after only 8 months as a dial painter, she had to leave to nurse her mother again. She was the kind of woman who wouldn't have begrudged that for a second, and so she simply bade farewell to her friends and went back to Utica, where she remained even after her mother's recovery, keeping house. She gave the studio little more thought as she turned her attention to her next dream, having a family with Hobart. It meant she wasn't there when, later in the 1920s, the radium dial bosses took a company photograph. All the girls, there were just over 100 of them in attendance that day, filed outside to have their picture taken. The company men were there, too, just Mr. Reed and his caretaking colleagues, not the executives from head office. The men sat cross-legged on the ground in front of the women, Mr. Reed donning a white flat hat and his usual dark bow tie. The girls ranged behind the men, some sitting on benches, others standing on the steps of the old high school. 3 rows of dial painters, as jolly a bunch of girls as ever there was. Many had their hair bobbed short in the latest flapper style. They wore drop-waisted dresses, embellished with long scarves and strings of pearls. "We used to wear our street dresses to the plant," Catherine Wolfe said. But what street dresses they were! Catherine sat on the front row, in the center of the picture, just to the right of Mr. Reed and Miss Murray. It was perhaps a sign of her seniority. As one of the longest-serving employees, she was now a trusted worker who would, on occasion, assume duties above and beyond dial painting. That day, she wore a dark, mid-calf-length dress with a long necklace of black beads. Her feet and hands, as they often were folded neatly together. She wasn't like Marie Becker, who would broadly gesticulate as she made one joke or another. Now all the girls, the jokers and the quiet ones, the conscientious and the unconcerned, sat still for the photographer. Some hugged each other or interlinked their arms. They sat close together, staring at the camera. And as the shutter closed, it captured them all together, frozen in time for just one moment. The girls of Radium Dial, outside their studio, forever young and happy and well. On the photographic film, at least. 11. Newark, New Jersey, 1924. Dr. Barry had never had such a busy January. Patient after patient came through his door, pale hands clutched to thin cheeks, discomfort obvious in the women's questioning eyes as they asked him what was wrong. Perhaps worst of all was Marguerite Carlo, who had first come to him on January 2nd with evidence of a recent tooth extraction that had begun the process of the jaw necrosis he was seeing in so many girls. Catherine Sharb was back again. The newly married Hazel Kuzer was attended by Barry's partner, Dr. Davidson. Josephine Smith, the Orange Plant's forelady, and her sister Genevieve also sought treatment. Genevieve was best friends with Marguerite Carlo and was extremely anxious for her. In all, to varying degrees, the dentists saw the same mottled condition of the bone. In all, they saw an illness that they knew not how to treat. Although they never let the girls see their perplexity, the dial painters would never have had the audacity to question them anyway. "I felt Dr. Barry knew what he was doing," Catherine later said. "I couldn't ask him why my condition didn't improve." Catherine's nerves were still very bad. It was as much as she could do to get through the day, let alone ponder on complex medical matters. For Barry, the sheer number of cases now proved his previous argument that the problem was occupational. He truly believed that phosphorus in the paint was to blame. The symptoms were so like those of Fossey jaw that it had to be the issue. Despite their aching jaws, the Smith sisters were still working in the studio that January. Barry now gave them an ultimatum: quit their jobs, or he would refuse to treat them. Josephine Smith ignored him. Yet, on seeing her friend's conditions, she did take some precautions at work. When she weighed out the material for her team, she tied a handkerchief over her mouth and nose to avoid inhaling the dust. Probably because some of the afflicted women were still working in the plant, rumors of Barry's threats soon reached the ears of the USRC managers, somewhat to their annoyance. Business was going well. President Arthur Roeder's company had contracts with the U.S. Navy and Army Air Corps, as well as many hospitals and physicians. Undark was by now considered the standard material for government use. Evidently, the firm wanted nothing to get in the way of all these business opportunities. Thus, on hearing of Barry's gossip-mongering, as they probably saw it, they were moved to write to their insurance company in January 1924 to reassure them of the situation. There recently have been rumors and comments made by individuals, particularly dentists, they wrote, in which they claim work in our application department is hazardous and has caused injury and poor health to a former operator of ours, probably Marguerite Carlo, and they are advising that other of our operators should discontinue being in our employ. It may seem striking that the deaths of Molly Maggia, Helen Quinlan, Irene Rudolph, and Catherine O'Donnell do not feature in this correspondence. But all four women had quit their jobs at the plant well before their deaths, some several years before, and it seems the firm was unconcerned about and possibly ignorant of their deaths. If it had chanced to hear of them, it was only Irene's case that had been attributed to her work, and as the doctors thought it phossy jaw, and the firm knew no phosphorus was in the paint, it could rest easy that the suspicions were unfounded. From their point of view, Irene was an orphan anyway, whose parents had died young. With a genetic inheritance like that, she was probably never long for this world. As for the others, if anyone at the firm had investigated the mysterious deaths of their former employees, officially, Catherine had died of pneumonia, Helen of Vincent's angina, and as for Molly Maggia, well, everyone knew she had died from syphilis. The firm had employed over 1,000 women during its lifetime. Four deaths from such a number was probably to be expected. The company, therefore, concluded confidently, "We do not recognize that there is any such hazard in the occupation." But by this time, their former dial painters disagreed. On January 19th, there was a meeting held in Dr. Barry's office with at least Catherine Sharb, the Smith sisters, and Marguerite Carlo present. The girls talked over their identical conditions with their increasingly concerned dentist. "We discussed employment at the radium plant," Catherine remembered. "There was some talk of industrial disease." The girls agreed. There was something going on about this thing. Yet, what could they do about it? Catherine had already complained to the authorities, and nothing had come of it. Even though the evidence pointed to some problem at the plant, no one really knew what the cause was. And much more pressing for the women than the cause, anyway, was searching for a cure, or at least some relief. Their health was their primary concern. Hazel Kuser was by now almost constantly on palliative drugs because her pain was agonizing. Marguerite Carlo had come to Barry hoping for treatment of her jaw, but she was to be disappointed. "I refuse to operate on the girl," Barry later said, "for the reason that previous experience with Irene Rudolph and Catherine Sharb taught me that the moment there was any operative procedure attempted, the case would flare up and would be much worse than it was at the time I saw her." And so, although the girls were racked by pain from their teeth, he refused to remove them. All he could offer the panicked women was to keep them under observation. He couldn't see what else he could do. He did ask others for help, consulting a highly skilled Newark physician, Dr. Harrison Martland. But when Martland examined the girls, he, too, was puzzled. "After seeing several girls in the dental office," Martland later wrote, "I lost interest in the matter." The girls were on their own. Just down the road at the Orange Orthopedic Hospital, Grace Fryer wasn't having much more luck. Just as she'd promised her parents, she had kept her appointment with Dr. Robert Humphreys to have her painful back and foot examined. Humphreys was the head doctor at the hospital, an exceedingly high-grade man. A Canadian in his 40s, Humphreys listened carefully to Grace's complaints, and then diagnosed muscle-bound feet and chronic arthritis. He strapped her up for several weeks, but noted with concern that there was very little improvement. Humphreys was treating another young woman that spring by the name of Jenny Stalker. He didn't connect her with Grace Fryer, who worked in a bank, but Jenny had been a dial painter until 1922, and she and Grace had worked together during the war. She had a very peculiar condition of the knee that had been mystifying Humphreys ever since he had taken her case. So many doctors across New Jersey were confused that first month of 1924, but they didn't share notes, and so each case was viewed in isolation. As January drew to a close, Theo and Hazel Couser decided that they would look elsewhere for treatment.